This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 384 was produced on July 13, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. 42 Macro founder Darius Dale returns as this week's feature interview guest. Darius and I will discuss what the bears got wrong and why Darius thinks there's still some upside left in the stock market before it ultimately reverses direction to vindicate the bears. We'll also discuss inflation, why the macro backdrop has changed considerably, and finally, China's recovery and why it didn't have the expected effect on global demand recovery.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, July 12th, 2023. The S&P 500 September futures were up 51 basis points, closing at 4507. We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch in the post-game segment. The U.S. dollar index down 271 basis points, closing at 100.55. Material breakdown, particularly after the CPI numbers were released. The August WTI crude oil contract up 552 basis points, closing at 75.75. We'll take a look at that chart in the post game as well. Eric will have the EIA inventory data. Gold up 180 basis points to 1961, attempting to break out after a month-long consolidation. And copper up 212 basis points to 385, upticking as many commodities are gaining tailwind this week. Uranium down 36 basis points to 55.55, and the U.S. 10-year Treasury yield down 4 basis points, closing at 386. The key news to watch this week is Friday's University of Michigan consumer sentiment levels. Next week, we have the Empire State Manufacturing, retail sales, and the start of the July earnings releases. This week's feature interview guest is 42 Macro founder Darius Dale. Eric, why did we get Darius back on the show this week?
Patrick, Darius has had a terrific track record on his last couple of appearances here on Macro Voices. And so we wanted to pick up on that because his last appearance, which was in January, he said, okay, don't expect any fireworks to start. Everybody's calls for the recession in the first half. It's not going to happen until the second half. That was his call. Needless to say, it's the second half. Time to get Darius back on for an update since he nailed the last couple of calls that he made on the show.
Eric's interview with Darius Dale is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is 42 Macro founder Darius Dale. As always, Darius has prepared a terrific slide deck to accompany today's interview. I strongly encourage everyone to download it. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click on the red button above Darius's picture on the homepage that says Looking for the Downloads. You will notice that some of the pages are blurred in this slide deck. The reason is that out of respect for Darius's paying customers, we normally use the previous month's deck for these interviews. This month, Darius wanted to use this month's deck because he's got some slides he wants to show you that have current up-to-date information. In order to respect the paying customers, we had to blur out at least some of the slides in the deck. So the ones that we're not talking to in this interview, please don't be alarmed if they're blurred out when you get the download. Darius, it's great to have you back. What I want to do is set the Wayback Machine to January of 2022. That's 18 months ago. You came on, everybody else is saying, okay, 4,800 on the S&P, just about to hit 5,000. We're headed much higher. Everybody's buying the dip. And you're saying, no, 2022 could be a crash year, were your words. I'm going to say you got that 99.44% right. The only nitpicky thing I might say is it wasn't actually a crash. It was actually fairly orderly the way that the market sold off. But you totally called that bear market. When we brought you back January of this year, everybody was convinced that the U.S. was about to fall into imminent recession. You said, no, I think that's coming, but not till the second half. And then you went on to emphasize, we've had the growth event, but we haven't had the credit event yet. It's not till we get the credit event that the rest of this story unfolds. Well, Darius, I was thinking about you as I watched the news come out about First Silicon Valley Bank, First Republic, Credit Suisse, and I thought, that must mean the market is about to crash. But wait a minute, the market didn't crash, but we got the credit event, or at least I think we did. What's going on?
Hey, Eric, thanks again for having me back. I'm very grateful to be a regular contributor to this program, wonderful program. So I'll start by answering your question directly. No, we do not think the Silicon Valley Bank incident and the First Republic Bank incidents was the credit event. Recall that we were sort of calling for a phase two credit cycle downturn, which is what happens to the markets when the economy is trying to price in the nonlinearity of a recession. That process is still very much ahead of us, but we do not believe that process is imminent, and we still believe that there's right tail risks left to price in the equity market and credit markets.
Right tail risks to price in. So you think there's more upside before this is over. Now, how does that jibe with, I realize you do some pretty fancy math in your analysis, but going back to us simpletons who think about Fibonacci analysis, we're already past the 61.8% Fib retracement of the overall bear market. Seems to me like if this is just a bear market rally that's going to roll over, it's kind of overdue for rolling over. It's getting pretty long in the teeth. How much longer do we have before this plays out?
Yeah, so that the answer to that question really is derived from understanding where you are in the business cycle. Historically, what we found is that the degradation in the market cycle tends to be fairly coincident, if not slightly leading, ever so slightly leading, with the degradation in the employment cycle. So if you look at slide 65, and actually, even before we get to slide 65, I just want to take a step back and say, one, thank you for the very kind intro. You know, one of the things we talked about the last time we were on the program was the fact that we were going to have a recession that was most likely to commence in Q4 of this year, or Q1 of 2024. So obviously that call was, you know, prescient. But, you know, the reason I bring that up is because that resilient U.S. economy theme has been the overwhelming driving force of the stock market this year and of credit markets and credit spreads tightening. And so, you know, we were actually, you know, if we go back to listen to our discussion in this January, I was actually bearish in that discussion. I think we recorded on January 3rd and it was released on January 5th. It wasn't until January 12th until we actually pivoted bullish as a function of that theme. So definitely wanted to explain why we made that call in terms of pivoting from bearish to bullish in mid-January and ultimately where we think the how much, you know, kind of where we are in that process. So jumping into slide 65, where we show a compendium of indicators in and around U.S. recessions, you know, the labor market, the markets itself, and then how the equity market relates to the labor market leading up to recessions. I'll draw your listeners' eyes to the column that says S&P 500 max drawdown. And so this is the max drawdown, the S&P 500 in and around recessions. And this is all the post-war recessions that we have in the U.S. economy. And what you see is that on a median basis, the max drawdown is -24%. With an interquartile range of -19 to -39%. In our view, that process still is ahead of us. But what is also still ahead of us, in our opinion, is the columns that suggest, you know, 1 year ahead of peak, 6 months ahead of peak, and 3 months ahead of peak. And, you know, partially, you know, while we knew that we didn't know, no one knows anything about the future, so I'll be humble and suggest that. But one of the things that gave us an indication that 2023 could see some right tail risk when we pivoted to that call in mid-Jan was that you typically see very strong markets leading up to the start of a recession. In fact, if you look at the S&P 500's performance 1 year ahead of its peak prior to a recession, it's typically up on a median basis +16% with an interquartile range of +14% to +20%. And there are no non-double-digit values in this 12 business cycle sample. And you see that the performance tends to accelerate towards the end. And the S&P 500's performance 3 months ahead of its peak is on a median basis is +9% with an interquartile range of +5 to +11%. And so that's obviously well above, you know, your standard rolling three-month return in the equity market. And so why does this happen? That tends to happen as a function of the positioning cycle. You know, positioning is one of these big cycles that we have to get right as investors. It's not just what the macro fundamentals are, but it's how is everyone positioned relative to the likely distribution of outcomes and how those outcomes play out. And so jumping to slide 76, where we show a couple of our, you know, our aggregated positioning metrics, one for the most recent CFTC report and one for the CFTC report that was just predated the October 22 S&P 500 trough. And as you can see, how we track aggregated positioning is we look at non-commercial net length as a percent of total open interest, and we amalgamate each of those for all the markets that represent U.S. equities, U.S. rates across the entire curve, U.S. dollar across all major currencies, and all the commodity markets that the CFTC keeps a track of. And what we can see right now is that aggregated positioning, so non-commercial net length, speculative net length as a percent of total open interest, is only in the 26th percentile of all readings dating back to, you know, the beginning of, I want to say, of late 1998 when we have the first equity futures and options data. That number was in the 21st percentile at the October 2022 lows. And so what that tells me is that despite seeing the sharp rally that we've seen in stocks year to date and the tightening of credit spreads, et cetera, we have not seen too much participation on behalf of institutional investors. And this is somewhat concerning for anyone who's bearish in the context of what we just talked about on slide 65 in terms of the crescendo of short squeezes leading up to ultimately that phase two credit cycle downturn that we still see ahead of us.
Tell me more about why you still see the phase two credit cycle downturn ahead of us. To your credit, you completely predicted that. You told us all about it back in January. But then we had Silicon Valley Bank and these other things. You're saying that's not the credit event you were looking for. So it must be that you're expecting a very specific kind of credit event. That one didn't qualify. Tell me more about exactly what you're looking for, why the one that just happened didn't qualify, and what you think might be coming.
Yeah, absolutely. So I can just, in terms of why the one that just happened does not qualify, in our view, we had already seen a pretty substantial degradation in credit standards, or, you know, degradation in lending standards, et cetera, from the Senior Loan Officer Survey report that was released in January. When we updated the data for the month of April, which is post Silicon Valley Bank, post First Republic Bank, et cetera, it deteriorated at the margins, but we didn't see a significant degradation. And so that was our first indication in April that, hey, look, this is getting worse, but it's not going to get worse at the same pace. And we've also been religiously tracking every week for 42 Macro subscribers, you know, the growth rate of credit, particularly amongst the sort of small banks or whatever the Fed calls small banks, which are any bank outside of the top 25 in assets. And we did see a significant downshift in the growth rate of their total assets. And that was primarily driven by them continuing to puke treasuries off their balance sheet. But we also saw them, you know, really start to rein in the lending, particularly through the lens of C&I lending. The most recent data is down somewhere around 1.5-2% through month annualized. But that 1.5-2% through month annualized, in terms of the contraction that we're seeing in C&I lending, you know, the slowdown in overall loan growth to right around, you know, plus 1-2% through month annualized, those numbers are actually higher than they were a few months ago. And so, you know, I don't want to make the definitive call that we're actually accelerating in terms of bank credit growth, particularly by some of these beleaguered, you know, small banks, regional banks. But it certainly is the case in our view that this is not the boogeyman that a lot of investors believe it is. And we had an inclination that it might not be the boogeyman, you know, as early as April in terms of that senior loan officer survey data, because one thing we find in terms of, you know, trying to understand the credit cycle broadly on a, you know, cross geography basis is that the U.S. economy is among the world's leading economies as it relates to this sort of the proliferation of non-bank financing throughout the economy. If you look at the share of overall credit that is actually on bank balance sheet in the U.S. economy, that number is only at 30%. That compares to right around 50% for the Eurozone economy, right around 80+% for the Chinese economy. So we know that the shadow banking sector, which tends to take its cues from things like the dollar, from things like the S&P, the VIX, the move index, you know, these kinds of market-based measures of stress, these market-based measures of stress have reflexively fed upon themselves and kept the credit machine going for some of these shadow market participants or non-bank lenders. So that, in our view, is something that has contributed to the resiliency of the U.S. economy that we called out and is likely to continue to contribute to the resiliency of the economy, at least until we get into the fourth quarter, when I think the probability of the economy actually commencing into a recession or tipping into a recession is actually you know, pretty elevated. So you asked me kind of what is the main driver of the sort of business cycle, the credit cycle that we see coming. And I'll direct your audience to slide 60, where we sort of expound upon our Hope Plus I framework. And so on this chart, it's somewhat of a busy chart, but it's important to explain. This is the median trailing 10-year delta adjusted Z-score of a basket of indicators in months before or after recession starts that represent each of these five cycles. There's the housing cycle, There's the order cycle, there's the production and profit cycle, and there's the employment cycle and the inflation cycle. We've added the inflation cycle to our buddy Michael Kantrowitz over at Piper Sandler. He's got this HOPE framework, and so we've expanded upon that and added inflation to the mix. And so what we find is, you know, very similar to Michael's work, is that housing tends to break down, very long leading indicator of the business cycle, so right around 18 months ahead of recession. Orders tends to break down right around 8 to 10 months ahead of recession. Production and profits tend to break down right around 4 to 6 months ahead of a recession. And employment tends to break down right around at the start of recession, and inflation is a very much a lagging indicator to the business cycle, breaking down right around 6 to 8 months after recession. Well, if you go to the current data, the next slide on slide 61, you see that we're basically just following this long-term, you know, pattern of behavior in U.S. business cycle, you know, kind of to a T. You know, housing broke down a long time ago, then we got orders breaking down, now we got production and profits breaking down, employment's on its way to breaking down, but it hasn't broken down quite yet. And so, you know, that's kind of a boring answer to your question. I know this isn't sexy, but, you know, making money in financial markets should not be sexy if you're doing it right. This is a very regular, stereotypical business cycle as defined by, you know, the previous slide, which encompasses all 12 of those post-war business cycles. You know, every post-war business cycle that we talked about on slide 65 is represented in the collection of data that we feed into each of these cycles. So this is a regular run-of-the-mill business cycle. It's going to have more than likely a regular run-of-the-mill phase two credit cycle downturn. And ultimately, we just have to be patient in terms of respecting the x-axis on all these processes.
Okay, Darius, let me summarize what I think I'm hearing, and you can tell me if I've got it straight. With respect to the recession that a lot of people started predicting in Q4 of last year, which you told us, not till the second half of this year, you're saying it's still coming. It's still not until the second half of this year. More likely, it's actually pushed out a little bit further to the fourth quarter of this year, or maybe even the first quarter of next year. You still think that it is a stage two credit downturn that brings on that recession. But so far, we don't know exactly what the details are going to be, and it's not the whole Silicon Valley thing. It's something else that's still coming. Is that the gist of it?
Very much so, my friend. You mentioned one thing in terms of, you know, just kind of timing the recession. So we run a variety of models to try to time where we are in the business cycle. Obviously, you know, you can't have an entire investment process based on, you know, is it a recession or is it not a recession? You're not going to make any money for the, you know, 95% of the time that we're not in recession. So very clearly, you know, it's more than, you know, investing is more than just understanding, you know, these kind of huge business cycle inflection points. But in and around, you know, these business, huge business cycle inflection points, you better have a good idea on what a recession is, what a recession looks like, how it gets priced in, how ultimately markets, you know, what causes markets to recover from that. And I think we have a pretty good handle on that here at 42 Macro. One thing that gave us a pretty good indication that a recession would be a Q4 2023 or Q1 2024 incident is the yield curve, which I think we would all agree, you know, citing Campbell Harvey's work in terms of dating the business cycle. I think we can all agree that the 10-year, three-month treasury yield curve is the best leading indicator for a recession. It certainly is, and from my perspective, if you go to slide 62, where we show the long-term time series of the three-month 10-year treasury yield curve, the black dotted lines in that time series correspond to the initial inversions. And if you look at the next slide on slide 63, this is where the math begins and the understanding, you know, really starts to take off, which is our math suggests that, you know, a recession was most likely to commence in November 2023 through April 2024 when we performed this analysis when the yield curve inverted last fall. And so what we're looking for in terms of making these determinations is okay, well, let's identify the interval of time that has the highest probability of seeing a real GDP contraction and a rise in the unemployment rate based on, you know, the historical patterns of yield curve inversions. And what we find is that it's the 13 to 18 month forward interval that has the highest percent or highest likelihood of seeing a contraction GDP vis-a-vis the percent negative ratio down there on the table, and the highest probability of seeing a rise in the unemployment rate, which is in the percent positive ratio in the table. So that suggests that Q4 to Q1 of this year was always going to be the highest probability outcome for recession for those who took the time to do the work. So that's kind of one point I'll make on that. And another thing, that there's a compendium of reasons why the economy has resisted recession thus far. And on balance, I think the compendium of reasons of why the economy has resisted recession thus far favor a soft landing more than they favor a recession starting in the very near term. If you think about a distribution outcomes, is okay, recession here in the Q3, recession Q4, Q1, and recession, you know, or no recession or significantly delayed relative to Q4 or Q1. And I think clearly the modal outcome of that distribution is Q4 or Q1. But I think the second highest, you know, hump in that curve would be no recession or significantly delayed relative to Q4 or Q1, as opposed to a recession commencing in the third quarter. And we can unpack why those features of the economy are persistent.
Okay, Darius. So most likely scenario is the recession still happens Q4 or Q1, but the second most likely scenario is the recession doesn't really actually hit us completely and it's more of a soft landing type of thing. First of all, is that correct? And second of all, yes, please elaborate on unpacking those details you alluded to.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. And the answer is yes, that is correct in our view. There's still a compendium of factors ongoing in the U.S. economy that would suggest that, you know, the resiliency that we highlighted, you know, dating back to last fall and discussed at the beginning of the year with you, that resiliency is likely to persist for at least another quarter, perhaps another couple of quarters. So we'll start on slide 48 with reason number one of six. We have record cash on household balance sheets. So this is something that's been a BMI bonded for months now, for quarters now, which is this concept of excess savings on Wall Street. And, you know, for the life of me, I think I do as much research as anybody on Global Wall Street as a single human being. And I can't for the life of me get to anything that looks like, you know, a negative value for excess savings or even a, you know, remotely close to being a negative value. When you look at the amalgamation of checkable deposits and currency on household balance sheets, we are now tracking at $4.5 trillion. That number is up from just around $1 trillion prior to COVID. Now, if we want to talk about excess savings, the excess savings are obviously very plentiful as opposed to having dwindled to a very threatening state. And another way to kind of look at this is the checkable deposits and currency as a percent of total household assets. And so consumers not only have a lot of cash sitting in terms of their ability to spend into the economy, they probably feel very rich because that amount of cash is very high relative to the total amount of assets they have, that liquidity. At 3%, you got to go all the way back to the late 1960s to see a share of checkable deposits and currency on household balance sheets that is as high as it is today. A couple of final things I'll make on the slide here on 48 is household debt to nominal disposable personal income is actually quite muted relative to previous cycles. So that's, you know, it certainly hasn't been growing in a way that would suggest capital misallocation in any broad form across the economy. And then you have the household debt service ratio, which is essentially at an all-time low still. It's going to rise in subsequent quarters, but it's coming off a very low base, and it's certainly not rising at a speed that would threaten a recession. Shifting to slide 49, we show the same metrics for the corporate sector in the U.S. You know, we're at a record level of cash on corporate checkable deposits and currency on corporate balance sheets as well, and right around 3% as well of total corporate assets. You got to go back to the mid or sort of early to mid 1960s to see a ratio of checkable deposits to total assets. So corporates probably feel pretty rich as well. Corporate debt as a percentage of nominal gross domestic income is pretty elevated. So that's a bit worrisome, but clearly not growing at a pace that is indicative of broad capital misallocation. And then you look at the corporate debt service ratio, it's at a very middling level. It's going to continue to rise in the coming months. But as we all know, corporates have termed out their funding. If you look at the percentage of corporate debt that's shorter term relative to longer term, it's right around 33%. So that number is obviously way down from where it used to be in previous business cycles. Number three, three reason why we've seen so much resiliency that we were able to make that call back then, which is that key measures of private sector income on slide 50 and wealth have outpaced inflation since the start of the pandemic. So obviously inflation has been an issue, but we have not seen inflation be enough of an issue that these measures of income and wealth have really been, you know, kind of gone negative on a real basis. So the blue line in this chart shows the household assets. If you look at their checkable deposits, plus their money market fund exposure, so amalgamating the total amount of cash they have on their balance sheet, that number is up 127% since the end of 2019. If you look at household net worth, the red line in this chart, that number is up 27% since the end of 2019. Corporate assets cash, so again, amalgamating their checkable deposits, plus their money market fund exposure, that number is up 47% since the end of 19. Nominal employee compensation is up 21% since the end of 2019. And then you also have CPI only up 17% since the end of 2019. So when you kind of add it all up, it's like inflation's going to catch up eventually in terms of dragging consumers into this negative real income state and ultimately kind of perpetuating a business cycle downturn. But it just hasn't happened yet. And so that's something we call out as well. Reason number four, I kind of alluded to this on slide 52, is that we have limited credit cycle vulnerabilities. So in this chart, I'm showing private non-financial sector credit to GDP. That's the blue line in the top panel. The red line shows the private non-financial sector debt service ratio. That's the red line in the top panel. And I show it on a 5-year Z-score basis in the bottom panels. And as you can see, the blue line at a minus 0.7 sigma, you know, we're clearly not growing credit in a way that suggests capital misallocation or adverse selection, which is what you typically see just looking, studying the time series ahead of the red bars showing up. You know, obviously, we're just not seeing that. We are seeing a sharp enough rise in the private non-financial sector debt service ratio, and that number is going to continue to go higher as a, you know, kind of long and variable lags of monetary tightening catch up to the economy. But you got to do a whole hell of a lot of, you know, tightening, financial tightening, you know, if you don't have the kind of capital misallocation vulnerabilities that you have historically had in previous business cycles. So it ultimately means that the terminal Fed funds rate, which is another call we made back going back to the fall of last year, the terminal Fed funds rate is actually, you know, going to be much higher because the neutral rate in this particular business cycle actually gravitated much higher. Reason number five, on slide 53, we have limited exposure to the volatile manufacturing sector here in the U.S. economy. The blue line in this chart shows manufacturing share of total non-farm payrolls. The red line shows manufacturing share of nominal GDP. And as you can see, at 14 and 18% respectively, we're well off prior highs, previous indicator. And what that ultimately means is that the more cyclical aspects of the U.S. economy are actually just significantly smaller shares in this in recent, you know, business cycles. And so ultimately, you know, the reason that's important is because, you know, if you look at the manufacturing sector as a, you know, kind of a, as a share of total job loss in recession, we show that on slide 89, where we show a compendium of indicators in the U.S. economy in and around recession. And what we see is that if you kind of go to the towards the middle of that table, manufacturing sector share of the total non-farm payrolls drawdown is 98%, which means that you tend to see, you know, services sector on in terms of the net job loss that we tend to see in the U.S. economy on a median basis on only 2%. And so, you know, what drives the services sector, things like population growth, migration, and, you know, are less cyclical than things that the things that drive the manufacturing sector, which are, you know, interest rates, exchange rates, you know, things of that nature. So that's something to call out. And then number six, the final reason we call out in terms of the things that are, you know, were, you know, evident at the time and still are some certainly evident in the data is labor hoarding on slide 54, where we just show the total labor force relative to its pre-COVID and post-GFC trend lines. And then we show the gross domestic income relative to its post-GFC trend. And you can see we've recovered the trend line in gross domestic income, meaning that corporates have, you know, probably demand for labor, which obviously you can see in the JOLTS report. But we just don't have the supply of labor as a function of, you know, the great retirement and other factors that are contributing to the reduction in labor supply relative to trends. So companies have found it very difficult to find and attract and retain talent in this business cycle. And as a function of that, they've just been reluctant to fire as quickly as they probably would have in other business cycles. And so in our view, you know, this is something that's been, you know, contributed to resiliency of the labor market and may continue to contribute to the resiliency of the labor market until you really start to see corporate operating fundamentals really deteriorate.
Darius, so far we've been talking primarily about growth-related issues. Let's move on to inflation. Particularly, you know, I had Julia DeClercq on the show last week telling me she thinks we're in an immaculate disinflation. I hate to disagree with Juliet because she's a brilliant woman, but I'm just not buying it, and I think we're in a new secular inflation. But honestly, I don't have any good strong data to make my case with, so I can't wait to hear your take. I want to hear your short-term take, but honestly, what I'm much more concerned with is not what's going to happen in the short term, but longer term. Are we in a new secular inflation, or is this all going to blow over because it was just a transient effect from the pandemic, as so many people seem to think?
Yeah, no, great question. And I completely agree with your sentiments on Juliet. And for the listeners who have not had a chance to review Juliet's discussion from last week, definitely make time to review that. She's definitely one of the top macro minds out there in this space. So a huge fan of hers, huge, I have a lot of respect for her work. She's definitely one of those people on my short list of, if you disagree with them, you better come correct with the analysis. So shout out to Julia. Getting back to this discussion, on slide 85, we have observed a considerable amount of immaculate disinflation here in the U.S. economy. If you can sort of look at the top panel where we show a significant breakdown on a three-month annualized rate of change basis in median CPI to 4.7%, you know, we're as high as 7.6% in October of last year. We've seen a significant breakdown in trim mean CPI to 3.1% on a three-month annualized rate of change basis. You know, we peaked at 7.8% in this metric going back to December of last year. Median PCE, trim mean PCE, these numbers are really breaking down as well. We've also seen a pretty decent deceleration in core services, PCE inflation, ex housing. So super core inflation, which is Powell's current favored inflation metric, that sort of justifies their view. But at 3.8% through month annualized, that number's, kind of well off where we were, kind of a north of 5.5% in recent quarters. So we have seen a significant amount of disinflation, immaculate disinflation, that's really contributed to this transitory Goldilocks vibe, at least prior to the last couple of months in asset markets. And part of the reason for that, we are kind of labeling this as immaculate disinflation, is because it's immaculate. going back to slide 60 of our deck, we discuss our Hope Plus I framework, where we show inflation is the most lagging indicator of the business cycle. It tends to break down well into a recession on balance on a median basis. It tends to break down 6 to 8 months after the recession begins. And so it's our view, and it's our data's view, that we are not in recession. We can talk about why we don't believe we're currently in recession right now. But if you go back to slide 89, which we briefly touched on earlier, and draw your eyes over to the core PCE set of columns in the table, where you show the basis point change in T minus one means the delta that we observe in core PCE time series ahead of a recession in the year leading up to each of these recessions in the sample. And what we find is that core PCE is typically flat leading up to a recession, right around plus 5 basis points. And there's only one negative outcome in this sample leading up to the 81-82 recession. All other observations in the sample show that core PCE is flat or accelerating into recession. And so in the context of our Hope Plus I framework on slide 60, that in our view gives us a pretty clear indication that a lot of the disinflation that we've observed thus far in financial markets has been very immaculate relative to historical business cycles. So it's our view that we're going to see immaculate disinflation conclude pretty soon. And the reason for that is, if you go to slide 86, we've been tracking the supplier delivery times throughout the pandemic as a proxy for, kind of pandemic related inflation impulses. And you can see both with respect to manufacturing, which is the blue line in the chart, and red line is the services sector, which is, arguably more important for the inflation outlook from here. Both of those numbers are well below levels that have historically been consistent with anything but 2% or less inflation. In the black line, we show container freight rates. Those numbers are back to their kind of trend, pre-COVID trend levels as well. So a lot of the transitory inflation that we observed in the pandemic is now, in our view, has come out of the system, or is, very soon to come out of the system. We happen to think we'll see 1 to 2 more months of immaculate disinflation from a reported inflation standpoint. But when you get towards the latter part of Q3 and really into Q4, and the recession has not started, you're going to have a window of time between the end of immaculate disinflation and, let's call it, going back to that Hope Plus I framework, 1 to 2 quarters into the recession before you actually start to see some real positive outcomes as it relates to inflation. And one other thing that actually concerns me about this immaculate disinflation narrative in the second half of the year is that housing disinflation may take an unwelcome breather in the second half of this year as well. So on slide 87 in this chart, we show the top panel, the FIFA home price index on a 3-month annualized rate of change basis. That's the blue line. The red line are the rebars. The red line shows the year-over-year rate of change in that time series. We show Case-Shiller home prices in the second panel. Those numbers are rolling through month average, so they're a bit lagged. The shelter CPI in the third panel, and we show PCE housing deflator in the fourth panel. And what we show, and we've lagged the shelter CPI and the PCE housing deflator in this chart by 19 months. And the reason we've lagged it by 19 months, because that is the current lag between the impulse in home price appreciation and the impulse in the ultimate reserved impulse in reported inflation for the housing sector. And so if you go back to 19 months ago, over the next couple of quarters, 19 months ago, we saw a reacceleration in the 3-month annualized rate of change of home prices. In terms of looking at the FIFA Housing Price Index and the Case-Shiller Index. So that's something that is ahead of us in terms of potentially seeing what could be, kind of a dissipation of the disinflation in the housing sector. We know the housing sector is bottomed. Part of a couple of things that have really contributed to the positivity that we've seen in housing. So if you jump to slide 55 in this deck, you can see that the housing sector is experiencing a cyclical recovery now. I'll draw your eyes to the second panel in this chart, where we show housing starts are actually accelerating on a 3-month annualized basis, are growing at 54% on a 3-month annualized basis. If you look at new home sales in the bottom panel in this chart, new home sales are growing 88% on a three-month annualized basis. Those numbers are up 5.7 and plus 20% respectively. So why are we seeing this kind of robust recovery in the kind of the new home sales segment of the housing market, which is obviously more relevant to employment in particular? And the reason for that is on slide 56. So there's a variety of reasons for why the housing market has been resilient, and we identified these reasons going back to the fall of last year. We did not, I'll be very clear, we did not make the bull call on home builders, and so we definitely missed out on monetizing this research. But kudos to any of our subscribers who did monetize this research, because we definitely put it out there, which is, we have these very low mortgage debt service ratios in the U.S. economy at only 3.9%. That's the red line in the top panel. It's a very low mortgage debt environment to begin with, but certainly the mortgage debt service ratio is really low. And the reason that mortgage debt service ratio is low is if you look at the blue line in the second panel, the effective mortgage rate on mortgage debt outstanding is only 3.55%. The marginal mortgage rate for anyone in the market to buy a house is 7.31%. So that positive spread of 326 basis points is effectively causing a stasis in the existing home sales market and flooding all the demand and incremental supply to the new home sales segment of the market. And this is why in the bottom panel, you're seeing the housing starts to existing home sales ratio breach an all-time high in the most recent month of data at 38%.
Darius, let's move on to China. I think the biggest macro analyst mistake that a lot of people, myself included, made in 2023 was we were assuming that the recovery of China was going to be an economic recovery. We didn't really factor in the changing nature of the geopolitical world that we live in. And it seems like maybe China is not going to have exactly the same role in the global economy after the pandemic that it had before the pandemic. Give me the laydown. What do you see in terms of China growth? How come China didn't contribute to the recovery from the pandemic the way so many people thought? And what comes next?
Great question, Eric. I think that's a very important topic to unpack because, again, China is, we forget, the world's second largest economy. It's kind of been dormant for a few years now, but it is the world's second largest economy. It's the world's largest consumer of many manufactured goods. So we definitely have to make sure we understand it. And it obviously, relative to anyone benchmarked to EM type assets, it's clearly the lion's share of those assets. So it's a really important topic from the perspective of institutional capital allocators. And so we definitely make sure we monitor that alongside many other major economies in the context of our rate of change analysis. But if you go to slide 45, where we show our global liquidity cycle monitor, which sort of, kind of tries to track the most important metrics across growth, inflation, and policy, and we try to marry those changes in those metrics to systematic trade ideas. Right now, there's very few actually jumping off the screen right now. Brazil's kind of the only economy with that, with some systematic trade ideas as a function of this process. But going to China, which is the second row in this chart, one of the things we correctly thought, I guess, proved prescient on is the likelihood that China would reopen its economy back into the structural liquidity trap that it was already mired in prior to COVID. We've been doing this for long enough to have enough muscle memory and been refreshing so many of the same charts for so long that prior to COVID, this narrative around China was this economy that had a debt overhang and it was contributing to, below trend growth, demand growth, below trend inflation. And ultimately, in the absence of fiscal stimulus, which we ultimately got that the river card on that information in early March, in the absence of fiscal stimulus, meaningful fiscal stimulus, which they continue to be reluctant to supplying the market with in Beijing, they were very likely to reopen the Chinese economy back into that structural liquidity trap. And we can certainly see it in terms of some of these indicators. PMIs are declining in China. You have economic surprises. China has the lowest or second lowest economic surprise index level in the entire table of all the major economies in the world. And, it's just been one economic miss after another in China because, again, the political authority, the political will in China has been to resist the temptation to pursue large-scale stimulus programs. This is a Chinese economy that, in our view, has sort of, is very much aware of the private non-financial sector vulnerabilities that they have in that economy. You're talking about 200%+ of GDP, private non-financial sector debt to GDP. You're talking about an economy that is very much potentially mired in a middle-income trap. And so those two statistics are very incongruent and why we believe Beijing has been very reluctant to pursue again, kind of those large scale easing cycles of years past, which obviously coincide with, much more debt growth. And nowhere can you see China's disappointing recovery than in the inflation statistics. you know, minus, we got the most recent data points over this weekend. Headline CPI is tracking it, flirting with deflation at 0.0%. That's a minus 1.9 sigma value relative to the trailing 10-year mean. Core inflation is at 0.4%. That's a minus 1.9 sigma as well. Chinese inflation surprises are the deepest negative inflation surprises in the entire world. And so, you know, you kind of sum it all up. Part of the, there's a few things that are really weighing on the Chinese economy. One, you know, the degradation in the current account. Obviously, the rest of the world is just not demanding Chinese goods to the same degree as they were. And we're not seeing that sort of current account monetization that we've seen in historic cycles in China, whereby Chinese, you know, exporters export money. They convert that money because the currency is non-convertible. They convert that money at the PBOC, whose FX reserves, you know, kind of build as a function of that, into renminbi. And that renminbi has been really the lifeblood of the Chinese financial sector's growth in recent decades. That process has really slowed significantly as the Chinese authorities have tried to downshift that kind of business model and kind of change the shape and nature of the Chinese economy into a consumption-oriented economy. You know, they may be successful in that. I think it's way too early to tell, but certainly they are doing what it takes to be successful with that, which is, again, resisting the urge to go back to the wood on these previous cycles. So ultimately, we do believe, if you go to slide 105 in this deck, which I think is the final slide in the deck, we do believe that China is going to continue increasing liquidity. If you call China and Japan of the two economies that are most of the major economies that contribute to our global liquidity proxy, which is the sum of the global central bank balance sheet, the global FX or global broad money supply, and global FX reserves minus gold. We show that on slides 41 and 42 in terms of those metrics. The two economies that contributed most to the rise, the surge in global liquidity, you know, from the fall of last year to the early part of this year, were China and Japan. And China's, you know, kind of reopening really kind of wanted to aid and abet that reopening process. But it's pretty clear from our perspective that they no longer want to pursue such large scale measures. Now, they are pursuing measures. China has, you know, recently cut its loan prime rates, its 7-day repo rate. We suspect that a triple R cut is on the way as well. And so they're going to see, you know, more liquidity filter into the global economy and the global financial system vis-a-vis China in the coming months. It's just probably not going to be as significant as, you know, it was, you know, kind of going back to the fall of last year into the first quarter and early part of the second quarter of this year. And so in this chart, I'm showing the correlation to the year-over-year rate of change to of these select leading indicators to the China liquidity proxy. The China liquidity proxy is just the global liquidity proxy, but just focused on China. So we add the Chinese central bank balance sheet plus Chinese broad money supply plus the PBOC's FX reserves minus gold. And we look at a basket of indicators that have historically been proven to lead or be a coincident indicator of those cycles. And, you know, if you look at the indicator that is most, you know, has the most amount, maximum amount of information on a 3 to 6 month leading basis, it's the Chinese equity market. The locals know in China in terms of you know, when the next wave of liquidity or provision or the next wave of liquidity reduction is coming. And right now, as you can see, the Chinese equity market on the right, where we show the Z-scores of the latest values of those indicators on a cyclical basis, trailing 3 years, and a structural basis, trailing 10 years, you know, the Chinese equity market is telling you that, look, there's probably not a big wave of liquidity coming out of China. Now, again, there is more liquidity coming out of China. We do suspect our China liquidity proxy to end third quarter much higher than levels than it is currently today. That favors Chinese equities. But again, this is not your grandfather's or your older brother's China stimulus cycle. This is not, very, in our view, very unlikely to be to create significant demand for physical commodities, et cetera. And it's probably going to be very concentrated in terms of the market response to Chinese equities, which have obviously lagged in conjunction with that call we made back in February. We told investors, many of whom that had taken advantage of the China reopening theme at the time back in February, to liquidate all of their China and China-related holdings. And obviously that came to fruition. So we think it's that trade is overdone. It's probably time to get back into China. Just be aware that this is probably not going to spill over into the broader commodity markets.
Well, Darius, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview and a terrific slide deck. Obviously, we didn't get time to go to all 106 slides in the deck today. I encourage our listeners to peruse the deck. But for the benefit of our listeners who are not going to be satisfied with the abridged version of this and want the entire deck with nothing blurred, please tell us about what you do at 42 Macro and what does it take for somebody to get this slide deck, not the blurred version, but the whole version, and get it updated every single month.
Great question, Eric. Thanks again for having me. Again, as I said, as always, it's a real blessing to be a regular contributor to this to podcast. So in terms of acquiring our research, we make it very easy, very simple. You know, just a little bit of background on what 42 Macro is. We are a top end, top shelf, very, very top shelf institutional macro research firm. We service all the top asset managers that you, the who's who, if you can name them, they're probably a client, you know, from my 15 years on Global Wall Street. We service, you know, corporations, central banks, et cetera, with our research, but we have a twist. And the twist is, you know, I have a firm belief that everyone needs this information, not just the hallowed halls of institutional finance. I'm you know, very big in terms of democratizing this kinds of information to make sure that, you know, retail investors, RIA type investors, which have historically not had the budgets to take advantage of research like this, can afford it. So our price points are extremely affordable. You know, I'm constantly doing market research to understand, you know, where the price points are gravitating towards in this business. And, you know, we are still very much on the low end of pricing our product. Because again, I think, you know, I don't believe that we need to be embargoing this at high, in terms of high fees, et cetera. So definitely come check us out at 42 Macro. We have price points in terms of this. We publish a slide deck every month alongside a webcast going through each of these charts. Every week, we publish what we call our Around the Horn, which is sort of an abridged version of this deck, specifically as it pertains to what you should be doing in your portfolio from an actionable investment standpoint. And then lastly, we obviously publish our Leadoff Morning Note every morning, which is kind of connecting the dots on all the things that are moving in the growth, inflation, liquidity cycles, et cetera. So again, definitely come check us out. If you can't afford our research, which is obviously very reasonably priced, we do obviously do a lot of podcast appearances as well. So come check us out at 42macro.com/appearances. You can definitely find a compendium of all of our podcast appearances, including this one when it's published.
Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to get an update from Darius. His charts are always amazing. Now, joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now, let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Darius's picture saying, looking for the downloads. Eric, let's cover crude oil, starting with those EIA inventory numbers.
EIA posted a crude oil build of 5.9 million barrels, which was really only 5.5 million barrels after another 0.4 million barrels were pilfered out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. I've lost count whether that's the 14th or 15th consecutive week in a row that they have continued to draw down the SPR during the period that they promised us they would be refilling it. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down a very, very large 1.6 million barrel drawdown. Gasoline drawing down a de minimis 3,000 barrels. Distillates building 4.8 million barrels. U.S. production ticking back down 100,000 barrels to 12.3 million barrels. Tape action, well, there was already a rally in progress before the data came out, and despite what normally would have been bearish data, that didn't slow the market down. EIA issuing an upward revision to its demand outlook was the principal factor behind this week's crude oil rally. We've reached a level now where, on a technical basis, it's starting to look like this could really have some promise. So, Patrick, I want to ask you to weigh in on the technicals. I see lots of reasons to be long-term bullish crude, and Dr. Anas Alhaji told us to expect the crude oil market to turn bullish in the second half. So maybe we're finally seeing the move that has promise. We'll have to get Anas back on for an update on the fundamentals. But meanwhile, Patrick, I'd love to know what technical signals you're watching to tell you that this isn't yet another bull trap, because we've had quite a few in the last year. And specifically, what signal will tell you when it's time to load the truck up on crude oil futures?
Yeah, Eric, it's been definitely a good 1-2 weeks on crude oil. It established a support line. It beat some key resistance levels around the very low 70s and is slowly re-entering the trade range from the first quarter of the year. What I think is interesting is to simply put on the 200-day and 50-day moving averages. And the reason I think this is interesting is simply because this one-year oil bear market, that has seen oil half itself off the major highs. We have a scenario where it's spent a considerable amount of time below the 200-day moving average, really depicting that bear market decline. You can see that the 200-day moving average now lies just under $80 and just a stone throw away from where crude oil prices are. The way I look at this is that if crude oil can start working up and sustain price action in the $75 to $80 area, it will be doing some technical repair work and potentially building the foundation from which a more meaningful bull breakout can happen. I think that what happens up along this moving average, notice the last time in April when it tested the 200-day moving average, it was a very hard rejection. It'll be interesting to see whether this time around the bulls can actually hold the ground and maintain it even above that red moving average, which is the 50-day. There's a lot of repair work. It'll probably take the rest of July for this chart to keep constructively building. And then we're going to really find out whether or not something more bullish can happen on a sustained basis. Nonetheless, let's move on to equities. Eric, what are you thinking here?
The market's doing exactly what I predicted it would do. It's melting up for what, so far as I'm concerned, is no good reason. This close to previous all-time highs, if you're still a bear, you've got to at least be considering the possibility of a double top before the market reverses lower. None of it makes any fundamental sense to me, but the trend is strong and the trend is up.
Yeah, the trend is strong. I want to talk about that in a little more detail, but let's first get the levels here from Nick's. Nick, what are you watching here on the S&P 500 based on the options market?
Spot price right now is 44.70. We have a call wall above at 4,500. Which is just about 30 points out. We have a put wall far below at 4,200. The implied move for the July 21st OPEX, which is next Friday's OPEX, is plus minus 60 points. So the upper expected move is 4,530 and the lower expected move is 4,410. With key resistance right now at the call wall at 4,500, key support below is at 4,400, 4,350, then 4,300. I'm thinking that we've gotten a bit too far, too fast. And it's probable we see some stagnation perhaps in the S&P. We'll discuss how far it is away from the all-time highs in a few slides. But again, I'm thinking that we see some stagnation here. So perhaps a little bit of risk off going ahead a few weeks makes a bit of sense given that we have FOMC in 2.5 weeks roughly. What are your thoughts, Patrick?
Yeah, the S&P 500 remains in bull trend. And while certainly you can make the argument it is overbought, based on all technical metrics, this is still a very distinct bull trend. Above all its moving averages, above all trend lines, but sequentially making higher highs, higher lows, all dips get almost immediately bought. And while obviously I think there's a lot of things that can go wrong later this year, there is simply no technical evidence that this market has run out of momentum right now and as some major top is really that imminent. And while we could certainly reach a little bit of short-term overhead resistance here on this market, there is really nothing stopping the bulls beyond a bad earnings season from trying to at least attempt to test those major highs. We'll talk about it in a second, but let's move on and just put the levels on the NASDAQ on here. What are you watching on the Qs?
On the Qs right now, spot price is 373. The implied move for the July 21st OPEX next Friday, again, is plus minus 8 points. So the upper expected move is at 381 and the lower expected move is at 365. We're currently above the call wall right now, which is at 370. There's a put wall below at 360 as well. And we've broken above that key resistance level from the highs of March 2022 of 372. The next key area of resistance now is at 383. Key support resides at 350. Again, I'm thinking that maybe seeing the blow off top perhaps in the NASDAQ. But I am favoring the Russell over the NASDAQ right now in the short term. And I do think that a pullback is overdue. But again, shorting, a very, very strong market doesn't make a lot of sense. So I'm neutral right now, perhaps, but I am looking for a short entry at some point.
All right. Well, you know what? On page six, what I wanted to do is put up the weekly charts of the S&P 500 capturing the 2020 COVID crash and the subsequent rally that came afterwards. And so I have the S&P 500, NASDAQ, and the Russell charts up here. And what stands out to me, Nick, is that and the NASDAQ, which is in the middle, not only had arguably the most violent sell-off in 2022, but also reflexively the most violent rally. And what's interesting is that the Russell, which also had that very violent drop, hasn't even been able to beat some of the short-term highs that it's seen over the last year. And so it's truly been a laggard. Like you were observing, we're a stone throw away from all-time highs. And it really makes me ask the question, I mean, really, what does stop this market from not going for a retest up there? I know that we have very overbought conditions, but there's also no immediate catalyst for it to start selling. How do you size this up?
So my thinking is that looking at these three different indexes, we have the S&P, which is about 7% from all-time highs, the NASDAQ, which is about 8% from all-time highs, and then the Russell, which is about 21% from all-time highs. So my thinking is that I'm staying long small caps in the form of the Russell, IWM, and this way, if I go short for NASDAQ or the S&P, for example, and we do run higher, I expect the Russell to outperform. So it's kind of like a pair trade in a way, somewhat. But my thinking is that right now, you can get about 5% risk-free on T-bills. So what would be the impetus for a portfolio manager, for example, to take the risk of further upside of about 7% on the S&P or 8% on the NASDAQ when you can achieve, 5% or so risk-free on buying bonds?
Yeah, that is the big debate. But I think right now it's really the fear of missing out that is driving, and as well career risk that is driving that money flow to chase these markets. And, the interesting thing is that you mentioned that you're pair trading the small caps against the NASDAQ as a way of creating some sort of a hedge. But what's interesting, Nick, is that when you size up these option markets, we have these incredibly low periods of volatility, and it really allows one to construct a number of really interesting option strategies to actually have hedges that are relatively cheap to carry and still have the ability to kind of soften the blow if there was a left tail downside risk to the markets that emerges going into this third quarter of the year. I want to talk about that a little bit more in a moment, but I just wanted to touch on, Nick, though, on page 8, the 3-month SOFR futures, but going out to December 2023 on the contract. And what I find really interesting is that even back in the second quarter of the year, they were pricing in by the end of the year that Powell was already going to have started a rate cut cycle that would have gotten yields down to about 4%. And that was really at its height was obviously the first shock reactions to the regional bank crisis. But what we find ourselves is trading right back down to February, March lows on this, where essentially right now they're still betting that the Fed funds rate will be somewhere near 5.25 as we get to the end of the year. And that basically Powell will at some point keep interest rates here at these kind of levels all year long. It'll be really interesting to see whether or not we have some sort of event going into the fourth quarter that makes the market rethink this, right? Darius was talking about the recession risks that are coming into the fourth quarter, into the first quarter. You would think some of the leading indicators might start to flash red signals that may force these interest rate futures to start actually pricing those things in. Nonetheless, Nick, on page 9, we have the VIX, and here we are literally trading back down to 2019 levels, 13 handle on the VIX. It just seems such a calm and complacent market here. What do you make of the VIX, and what levels are you watching?
So right now, spot's around 13.5. So this denotes less than 1% moves in the broad markets each day, roughly. Looking at the longer-term chart, typically when we trend down below that 16 area into the 13 area, it's possible to get down as low as 9-10 and have a very dull, gradual rise to the upside in broad markets. So hedging overall becomes a bit easier because you don't want to have that drag effect by purchasing insurance too preemptively. Ways that you can do this, perhaps, are using put spreads. And then the wider you go, obviously, the more asymmetry of risk you have, but you're also risking a bit more capital. If you go with narrower put spreads, for example, like $10 wides on SPX, the downside, you know, you can find asymmetry of risk where you're risking 2 to make 8 or 3 to make 7, for example, which isn't that great overall. But if you go a bit wider using, you know, 50 wides, for example, you can find some trades where you're risking, you know, $3 to $4 to make 46, for example, right? Again, these are tail risk trades where if the market were to sell off, you know, 5% all of a sudden or 7% all of a sudden, that's where you're protected, right?
I couldn't agree with you more, Nick. The skew in the options chain truly allows you to build some asymmetric payoff put spreads on the downside. They don't cost a lot, and they give you that really good intrinsic value kick if the market gets hammered to the downside. What I find interesting is that when we go on page 10 and we look at the VIX for the 1 year volatility, because the normal VIX chart we look at is 30-day volatility. What's interesting is we are also as well at multi-year lows again. I mean, we're not back to 2019 levels, but even volatility 1 year out is at multi-year lows. And one of the strategies, Nick, that I cover, and I'm doing a webinar on that as well, is the ratio backspread. And the ratio backspread, I haven't talked about it for years because high volatile conditions actually make it harder to implement and have all sorts of inherent risks with it. But the lower volatility goes, tighter that backspreads can be put on, and the less vega risk you have. It's a really interesting way to implement hedging. And I'm going to be doing a webinar on that actually, in not this upcoming week, but next week on July 25th. The links are in the chart deck and as well in the Research Roundup email. So anyone that wants to learn about these different option strategies, you're welcome to join me for that. But it's interesting, Nick, that volatility, like the market is just becoming so complacent, like a soft landing or no landing is really the most probable outcome. I'm really curious to see, you know, as we progress into deeper into the third quarter, whether or not the market ends up getting some sort of data point that actually makes everyone reprice risk again.
My thinking there is that, you know, Powell has said again and again that the Fed has not even thinking about lowering rates this year. And, you know, the markets are pricing in a few rate cuts by the end of the year. And that becomes less and less likely as we approach the end of the year, right? Because we have July, which is in a few weeks, they're probably going to raise rates by 25 basis points. August is a holiday, September, October, November, December. So the probability of cuts occurring this year are not very high. But remember that when the Fed pauses, typically that indicates the top in the market. So it's possible that it happens later on. Again, the catalyst is unknown as to the downside catalyst, perhaps. But it's important to be cautious because there is a lot of FOMO, as you said, in the markets right now. So moving on to page 11, we have the US dollar index. Eric, what are your thoughts here?
For weeks and weeks now, you've heard me saying, look, there's nothing to see here because we're stuck right in the middle of a wide consolidation range. But just in the last couple of days, this has gotten very interesting. The signal I've been waiting for is a daily close below 100 on the Dixie. And while we don't have it quite yet, we're down 3 big handles this week alone. And as of Wednesday's close, the Dixie is just barely holding above 100. If this dollar weakening move continues, it could accelerate on a sustained move below 100. And of course, that also means that the market could reverse much higher from here if critical round number support holds. So it's time to wake up and pay attention. But so far, the verdict is still out.
Yeah, Eric, the 100 level is really important. But I have to say, I was anticipating far more of a trade range bound currency market. And the sheer velocity of the US dollar breakdown has me having to go back to the drawing board to really ask what's going on here. It's going to be critical to see what happens here, because if we have a euro blowing out through above the 112 level on the upside, and we continue to see all the other cross currencies just breaking out right across the board, The question then becomes, is there another leg down in the dollar? And if there was, in my opinion, any one true tailwind for risk assets for the third quarter of the year would be a material repricing of the dollar lower. And I mean, nothing crazy, but like if we saw the Dixie heading down to the 95 handle, just levels where we saw it a few years back, that would certainly, I think, be a tailwind. And that could actually be the backdrop from which many commodities can rally. And even risk assets like equities would find that as a tailwind for potentially driving those previous highs. So watching what happens here in the dollar next is so critical. I think that in order for this to the bulls to neutralize this, we would need to see a rejection of the euro at 112 and a dollar index that gets right back into that trade range above that 101, 102 range in the coming week. So that's certainly the thing to watch there.
Now on page 12, we have the gold futures chart. What are you guys thinking here?
This move higher looks to me like it has legs, so kudos to Patrick for seeing it coming last week. One of the factors that may have helped turn the market around was a series of announcements over the last couple of weeks about the formative gold-backed BRICS contender for replacing the U.S. dollar as global reserve currency. Exactly as I predicted in my book, Beyond Blockchain, 5 years ago, the BRICS Alliance has now formally announced its intentions to assert a gold-backed reserve currency system intended for the express purpose of competing with the U.S. dollar as an international reserve currency for international trade settlement. The Western institutional finance community is either completely ignoring this or laughing it off as insignificant, but I think that they are badly overconfident. I personally see this confirmation as a very significant development, and the recent announcements serve to solidify my own strong bullish conviction for the yellow metal in the long term. What this means is that if, just by some crazy, unlikely chance, the almighty U.S. dollar should ever start to lose its monopoly over the global financial system, and if this BRICS alternative reserve currency system were actually to get traction and take off and become a meaningful part of the global financial system, then, as that currency gained popularity, it would be necessary for its managers to buy up more gold at whatever price the market commands in order to create more money supply. It's not discretionary buying based on an opinion about what value is, and it doesn't depend on anybody's personal opinion as to what an ounce of shiny yellow metal is worth. It's just a mechanical thing where if this BRICS reserve currency does start to take off, it's a guaranteed certain fact that they have to buy more gold regardless of price anytime they want to increase the money supply. But according to the Western finance community, there's no chance of any of this really happening because the U.S. dollar will always reign supreme, according to the exact same people who all insisted that the yuan-priced crude oil futures contract would never see any serious open interest or volume until it did. So I think they've badly underestimated this, and I think it's another reason to be very, very bullish in the long term on gold. But I digress. Returning to the current market, I think we still have a couple of rate hike surprises in our future. So I don't think it will be a straight line up for gold, and lower prices below 1900 are still entirely possible. But for the moment, it looks like gold is catching a bid, and the correction may be ending sooner than I originally anticipated.
Well, thanks for the kudos, Eric, but I don't know if I saw it coming. All we were just talking about was that, you know, we were approaching key Fib zones, the 200-day moving average was right there, and the U.S. dollar weakness is typically a condition that would be a tailwind for gold. So we had this breakout, and the breakout happened yesterday, and certainly looks like it's holding this morning when the time we're recording. What really, to me, it's not the breakout candle itself that matters, but rather whether the bulls follow through on it in the coming trading sessions. And the one thing that I think would be very disappointing for the gold bulls would be if this traded back to 19 and a quarter by midweek next week. What really needs to happen here for there to be a bull tailwind is this constructively crawl its way higher to 2000 and really start getting the attention from traders, investors that there's a new move underway. If that happens, a retest of its previous highs just below 2100 and even a breakout towards 2200 are all entirely on the table. The beautiful part about this is an early stage breakout, so there's a lot of upside here. Let's see whether the bulls can pull it off.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart techs, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
In the Research Roundup this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, the slide deck from Darius, as well as the chart book that we just discussed here in the postgame. There's also a link to a number of articles that we found interesting, as well as the link to the special webinar I'll be hosting at Big Picture Trading. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com. And we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend. That is Eric spelled with a K. And follow Patrick, @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening, and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.